Oh, the shame that will get if you let all the fans down.
Can we not lock this?
It's a fact. I'm not playing mind games. I'm talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladici, I would probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions on anything. Religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you, except for those two, have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
All right, welcome along to this week's Team 33. I'm Raf Giallo. As always, you can get in touch with us on Twitter. That's at Team 33. We're also on Facebook and also on iTunes. And you can find some interviews on our YouTube channel, like Richard Dunn, who is this week's interviewee. He was chatting to me last week at the Premier Sports launch, at the same time as Gary Breen as well. And you'll find that Gary Breen interview also on YouTube. We'll play that out, or at least the Richard Dunn one, later on today. But we are joined by Jonathan Higgins and Endicall. How are you?
Hi, Raf. How are you?
Before we get into playing any interviews or anything, obviously it was a big Premier League weekend. It's back. Man United stunned everybody. Liverpool and Man City did what they had to do. But it hasn't been overshadowed by VAR, but VAR has been one of the big, big talking points. I'm not sure how you kind of fell on how it appeared after that first weekend.
I actually thought it did overshadow the full weekend, because even I was watching Goals on Sunday with Alex Scott and who else was on? Alex Scott and Pardew. Alan Pardew was on, and every couple of minutes Alex Scott was bringing up VAR, because every couple of minutes there was actually a decision that they had to look at it. But so I think it actually did completely take over the talking points for the weekend, and it was disappointing in a way that did, because it was such a good weekend of football, but a lot of controversy that isn't controversy in a way.
But was it intrusive in the way it was applied in comparison to some of the other
it was a bit of a climate change straight away. Like it completely changed the dynamics of a Premier League game on one weekend. Like the way that we viewed football completely changed in the blink of an eye. Just one weekend, it was completely different to anything we've ever seen.
Right, which examples?
The Sterling one's the best example.
So this is the one where his armpit is slightly overline. And Ian Wright and Alan Shearer had very different views on Match of the Day over it.
Like, I think the whole discussion was around VAR and not the rules that VAR was enforcing, and that's the biggest issue here, because the problem isn't with VAR, it's with the rules, because VAR is only highlighting the faults within
the
description
the game,
within it. So is it okay that Raheem Sterling was offside by less than a millimetre? That's what the rules say. He is offside, and VAR was just, it's just technologically there that we can actually see that he's offside. So the problem wasn't with VAR, it's just with the rules.
The biggest thing for me was you could tell straight away who had actually watched the Women's World Cup and who hadn't, judging by the reaction straight away, because a lot of the things that we saw were things that happened multiple times during the Women's World Cup. There's two things really with it. I do think VAR is needed. I don't think it's perfect yet. I do think it will take a little bit while. That's another debate, whether it should be tested a bit more before it's rolled out. But a lot of the angry, over-the-top frustration is at times people are a little bit misled. And as you kind of touched on there, and particularly I thought with the Wolves handball one, where the people don't seem to realise that that rule change has happened. That is a handball instance now, and people are getting angry over the top. Oh, they're checking if you touch down. They're just checking for the enforcement of the new rule, which is there. And people, I find it laughable a bit how people are going over the top with that, because
the Wolves manager just on that game, Espiritu Santo, who was saying it's against the spirit of the game and all this stuff. And you're like, well, would you be saying the exact same thing if it was the other way around?
But even one of the Leicester players said after the game that, do they want us to cut off our arms now?
But that's nothing to do with VAR.
What's
the biggest point? Like, VAR isn't perfect, and we've seen, we'll talk a bit more tonight, and no doubt as the season goes on.
I'm hoping this is the final nail.
Safely say, Raf, now, sorry, there's keep aside plenty of segments between now and the end of the season. But in that instance, people going over the top have to go over the top of the rule, not VAR. And I find it very frustrating, because I've seen ex-players, I've seen fans, I've seen managers, I've seen so many different people. And, you know, like us all, I'm sure, swallowed up a load of different content after the weekend, and that's the biggest thing that I have gripe with, because it's just over the top. Listen, do you even realise what you're talking about here? Yes, VAR isn't perfect. I do think the Sterling one, that Man City game, turned a little bit laughable. The game had gone and it did go a little bit crazy, and I do think there is a genuine issue. I'm kind of in the middle of the fence with it, but I do think there's an issue, like even as simple as where do they pause the frame when they're showing the offside, because there seems to be a discrepancy between what VAR are checking and the rule. Like, I think VAR check the second it leaves your foot, makes contact with it. I think where the official rule says it's when it leaves your foot. So that little millimetre, we are talking millimetres here. That's gonna take a little while to get used to. And I do definitely see the point from being there in stadiums as well, where sometimes when you're at and they're checking for VAR and you just have a little announcement over the top, now we're doing a VAR check, and the fans having a Scooby-Doo what's going on. That isn't a good scenario either. But it is needed, I think, in the game, as we've seen many, many high-profile incidents. I think it is something that we're going to have to grin and bear with it. But I repeat, have to realise there's been a number of rule changes.
Yeah. See, it's kind of changed the debate a little bit, because before VAR came in, the debate has always been, is it a foul? Is it not a foul? Is it offside? Is it not offside? Whereas now you can't argue that it was, you can't argue that Sterling wasn't offside. It's, the debate has now changed to, is VAR being too precise that he's offside by a certain amount? Do we need to change the rules so that they have to be offside by a certain amount? It's completely changed the way that we're actually looking at the game as a whole. And that's what I mean by it was such a culture shock for us this weekend. But the likes of the Sterling offside would never have happened if VAR wasn't there. That's kind of where the issue I have on it, because originally VAR was put forward as a thing that's, if there's a clear and obvious error made, then VAR will come in and it'll make the decision whether it's offside. If a player is like Sterling, and you just use that example because that's the main example that I would use, and probably the Declan Rice penalty might be another example to use as well. That's not a clear and obvious error. Mm-hmm. The linesman has not made a clear and obvious error on that mistake. The issue now is that you can't actually use that debate, because you have to define what a clear and obvious error is for offside. How much does the player have to be offside for it to be a clear and obvious error by the linesman? But that's where I come in on it. It's really
so
difficult
what
for
you're
me.
Saying it's not clear and obvious. I think what is a clear and obvious error?
It's offside has to be clear and obvious though, and that's.
But
that's,
is it clear and obvious if is it a Did the linesman make a clear mistake with Sterling?
Well, the FA's point of view, what they will tell you is offside is clear.
By the letter of the law, he's technically offside.
You are going down to millimetres.
If you're using laser technology to check whether a player's armpit is offside, that is not a clear and obvious error for me. That's where I have an issue with it.
Yeah, but how do you define it then? Is it going to be a foot? Is it going to be a millimetre? With offside, you have to go back to the old way. If you're enforcing it for offside at all, you have to go down to the millimetre.
Personally, I think they need to change it to the bottom half of your body.
Okay, well that's a rule change. That's a rule change.
Naturally, people run with the front of their body leaning forward anyway, so that might be
Sterling.
Sterling does as well.
He kind of runs like a duckling.
He runs like a Transaurus Rex or something.
He's referenced himself anyway on social media.
When I do say that it's going to be a foot or should be a foot or a knee or a leg or something should be offside, clearly that is offside and it's a scoring part of your body.
Yeah, well that's a rule change.
But also then it's going to come down to someone's toe being offside, and it's the exact same issue. Yeah. So I think it's just something we're going to have to get used to.
That's the biggest thing, really. And I do definitely get the kind of the element of, you know, you celebrate and that's when your team scores, you know, you have that big raw emotion or whatever. And then you step back and go, hang on a second.
Yeah, because I don't know if I really bought, if I thought that might have been a slightly populist argument that some pundits were making, that it will ruin the atmosphere. But I think they're going to celebrate anyway.
It just changes the atmosphere.
Yeah.
It changes the fan experience because they're not celebrating straight away now. And then the opposition get to celebrate.
Saw the West Ham guys 2-0 down doing these wild celebrations. The closest I can think to is really the, from Wickedness and from a personal point of view, is the Origi fourth goal against Barcelona. But that had probably a multiple of different factors in it. The fact that you didn't realise that the corner had been taken and this actually happened at Liverpool got the fourth. But there was a little bit of, oh, is this actually happened here? But the speed of it was quite rapid, and it, we found out straight away. That's the thing. This thing has to be on the loop pretty quickly. And look, there will be teething issues. It's a case of getting that swiftness there, so there isn't that big lag, that big kind of false celebration, then come back, oh no, and you have egg on your face or whatever. You can't. I do see the point of stripping back the emotion, that side of the game, but I think there's no reason why that can't be enforced pretty quickly, and technology will get better as well. You see, the problem is if you go with the offside, you have to go down to the middle until we make a rule change.
Yeah, they're just going to have to define it better, and they're actually, as of today, they are looking into offside.
I look at that as a positive then from VAR, where they've realised, you know, the rule, you know, there's a bit of vagueness here. We need to get this better. We need to get this more defined, because you can't, like, if you can't praise goal line technology for being down to the absolutely minute millimetre and then not have it for offside. It's pretty much the same technology in effect. So, yeah, look, teething problems. Will it improve the game? I think it will. Overall, from when you look at it, once they get the technology up to speed, once fans realise, if you can...
I know, it'll certainly change the game.
It's so
whether it improves it from a fan experience, I'm still doubtful. It'll definitely improve it in the sense of it'll equalise the game a lot more, making it more fair, make it more even. But from a fan experience, I don't think it will make it any better. I think it'll actually make it a little bit
bit worse. You take those offsides, the pace of the game now is absolutely intense. How can the human eye spot where someone is offside? And, you know, especially when we spoke about the offside rule being, you know, a little bit vague, and then you realise, oh, he's not interfering, he's there. So the lines man or woman, whoever's the official on that side, do have a... I you know, you can only stand back and go, Jesus, I wouldn't be able to do it at times.
Yeah, well, from a professional aspect, 100% will improve the game. When you're talking about competition, when you're talking about the people who are involved in it, it'll improve the game for them. Mm-hmm. But will it improve a fan experience? I don't think it will, because it slows down the game. Again, you have a 90th minute winner and you don't know if you can celebrate that properly, because there might be a check in a couple of seconds and then by then it's gone. For me, it's good from a professional level and from a basis of it'll just make the game a bit more fair. But from a fan experience, I think it'll change it for the worse.
I think there's going to have to be a bit of kind of getting used to it, really, because what's the biggest one you can think of? Probably the Spurs Man City one in the Champions League, that offside, the late winner that was cancelled out. Nobody can argue for the neutral, of course, that wasn't great entertainment.
Yeah, well, the United handball against PSG as well.
Look at that, great entertainment.
One. Yeah. And I've been an advocate for VAR for a long time now. Like, I do think it is definitely a good thing when it comes to the game. But whether I'm going to enjoy watching football as much now on basis that I'm questioning every single goal that goes in, whether it's going to be called back, I don't know if I'm going to enjoy it as much.
Well, it's fine, I think, from TV, because you're still getting the running commentary. Maybe in the stadium it'll be slightly different, because I don't know. I haven't been to a match where there's been VAR on a big screen or anything, so I'm not sure how much information you're getting.
No, they're
as
not.
You're
they're
there.
Not going to. They're not going to show
gonna get
replay.
Anything, I presume. Yeah,
you'll get.
No,
it just
says that it's checking,
and they'll give you what the topic is that they're checking, if it's the goal or
even just from an armchair perspective. I sat in the couch for Sunday and Saturday all day watching the football, and I had notifications on Flash Score, as I always do, and it was so frustrating when I got a Flash Score notification to say there was goal, and then I look at the phone again 2 minutes later and it's correction, no goal.
Welcome to modern football.
I don't know.
First world problem right there. But obviously West Ham couldn't really quibble much. They were trashed 5-0. Norwich were beaten quite heavily by Liverpool. Chelsea, though, beaten very, very heavily by Man United. I've seen an argument, and maybe I buy into it slightly, it wasn't quite as impressive by United as the scoreline would look in terms of how they played.
God, no. Their midfield was invisible in the first half.
I thought it was two poor teams, yeah.
Yeah, like,
yeah,
somebody...
Obviously the scoreline then
somebody
is a big yawning gap.
Well, the second half was impressive for United, like, just how they went about it, but they were going up against a really inexperienced Chelsea side. Somebody put up a tweet before the game that showed a match between United and Chelsea from a couple of years back, and there's no comparison between the quality of the sides that went out in the pitch, and it's amazing how how far these two clubs have fallen in the last couple of years. But United in the first half, dreadful. Chelsea, kind of impressive, just didn't take their chances.
Yeah, if they actually, that game hinged on that time that Abraham hit the post.
Because exactly.
Because if United wouldn't be in that position where they can counterattack with the lead, so I think that
Chelsea
definitely had an effect.
Played into United's hand, particularly in the second half. They just became schoolboy stuff. Everybody just coming forward and having no protection, no cover whatsoever. And then we had those couple of kamikaze moments.
Well, Jorginho, not a proper defensive midfielder.
No.
Kovacic neither. Mason Mount's an attacking midfielder. There's
so
no
many.
Player.
If you look at the championship players.
Yeah, if you look at the team that they had out there, they had Christensen and Zuma, who neither of them were
both
Christensen wasn't starting for Chelsea last year. Zuma wasn't playing for Chelsea last year. Then they had Emerson, who couldn't get into the starting lineup last year. Mason Mount, who was playing championship football last year, and Abraham, who was playing championship football last year for the last couple of years, in fact. So you're expecting them to go out, even though United have an inexperienced side as well, five academy player products starting on the team. But Rashford, Martial, all these younger guys playing for United have been playing Premier League football week in, week out from the last couple of years. So
McTominay's had a full season under his belt as well.
Exactly. Like, the biggest bonus for United from the weekend was how well Harry Maguire and Wan-Bissaka and that back four in general looked. Compared, I know they were coming up against the Chelsea side.
I was very impressed by Wan-Bissaka, and I thought, like, all I've heard about him and from what I've seen, he's a great tackler, but he was actually really good on the ball as well, which was surprising.
He's not the best on the ball, but you will not get past him.
Yeah, there were a couple of moments, though, where he just seemed to be quite clever on it, which I hadn't really seen from his game before. But,
you'll have a lot bigger test, though. I thought Chelsea played into United, made it so easy for them. It was so laboured, it was so slow. I think there's been... I guess it's from having, you know, so many bad times together and being so much doom and gloom that one half decent result has kind of gone completely over the top. I thought Harry Maguire had a decent game.
I'm speaking
as a neutral here.
Harry Maguire was not just decent at the
weekend. Well, who was he up against? The championship
striker. You still have to go out and do the job that's required of him. He was man of the match. He was absolutely solid throughout. And that's me taking all of my United bias out of this.
Okay, well, I'll take my Man United, or take my Liverpool bias out of what, and kind of go through what summed up for me how far United have fallen. Was there was a couple of moments in Harry Maguire where there were basic schoolboy defender, where the ball comes in, he's heading us away, get the big roars, I get that. But there was a moment in the second half where a cross came into the box, nothing cross, like going absolutely no place. And he was on the right hand side of the penalty box. He went to kind of play down the channel, but instead of that, he sliced it wildly, went straight into the clear, looked like a great clearance, and there was a massive roar from all around the stadium. And I remember thinking to myself, this is Manchester United. How is this happening? That's how far things have dropped with him. He looked decent, but any defender, any half-decent defender would look decent against that sort of setup. It was so passive. Chelsea never...
I mean, you could say that about half of Van Dijk's performances from last year as well then.
Okay, fair enough. I definitely take the argument that it's a lot of the time, and I'm probably guilty of myself as a fan as well, you see him do a basic thing and it's like, way, whatever, he's the best of them. But you strip it back, he's going to... How much bigger test is Harry Maguire going to have?
Without a doubt.
And how much of the reaction and the praise towards Maguire was a result of not having half-decent defenders the last couple of years?
I wouldn't say all of it, though, because just like... Fair enough, I do take your point that there was a lot of focus on Harry Maguire, and because he did a good job, it was obviously amped up because United haven't had a defender.
And I get it, it's the debut of the big money signing.
But at the same time, he did his job.
Oh no, without doubt, yeah.
He did it very, very well. Regardless of the opposition, he commanded the back line, and a lot of it is down to United not having these players in the last couple of years, but... He commanded the back line like a proper centre half did. He was good on the ball. He carried the ball out of defence quite a few times, which I didn't really expect him to do. And he was a constant threat.
I think Kenny Cunningham has him down as the best ball playing centre back.
Yeah. Exactly.
That might be a push.
Did he say the world or Europe?
He said pretty much the best ball playing centre half going right now was what he said.
Liverpool fans didn't quite take that.
I wouldn't exactly go that far, but he was a constant threat in the box as well. And he did everything that was expected of him on his debut at Old Trafford, and so did Wan-Bissaka.
The tests will come when he is playing that high line. Look, when it comes to it, when it comes to a physical battle, he's an absolute beast in the air, man to man. Even I think it was the third goal where he had Abraham and kind of wrapped up around the edge of the box, and then he broke away. And I think he bust out the left wing and kind of half knocked someone over in the momentum, like just unbelievable charge out. I think it led to maybe the third goal, perhaps. But it's when he's in that sort of those kind of physical battles, you wouldn't back anyone else. But I've seen him close up. I've seen him struggle on the spin.
He's slow on the spin.
I've seen him struggle.
That's where
Lindelof
comes in, because Lindelof sits a little bit deeper and he's playing that.
The problem for me is when he comes on the United midfield, without being disrespectful, I don't think is great, particularly from a defensive point of view. I don't think there's a lot of legs there. I don't think there's a lot of cover. When you are playing the bigger teams and he is stretched up a bit more and there is that space, put it this way, if you're the opposition, that's where you're going to be trying to get in behind. You're going to be trying to get in behind Shaw, who looks a bit legless at times. So there's gaps there. It's how he reacts in that situation, because at Leicester, he had the benefit. Leicester played nice and deep, nice and compact. He's a lot of cover there. He didn't have to mark that space. England, he played in a tree. He had that extra little bit of cover. It's how he reacts to playing that high line over the course of the season.
See, against the bigger opposition, no, United aren't going to be playing a high line. They're going to be playing deeper. They're going to be playing the counter-attack. There's not going to be space in behind, and he has added.
There will be moments in the game where United will have to go first.
When they're on the break.
Yeah,
obviously, yeah. Yeah. But
because you talk about
the
game is like in the blink of an eye. You watch City, I suppose Liverpool to a lesser extent, even Spurs as well. It's those moments of transition where they get in behind gaps, pockets of space where they press. That's really if we're talking about the level of performance that deserves, I suppose, that type of reaction, that type of feedback after the game. That's the situations where he will have to react, and he will do it, but it is going to be the test how he reacts, because to date, anytime I've seen him in those situations, I remember even going back, I think it was New Year's Eve a couple of years ago, watching him play for Leicester at Anfield, and Salah, every time he spun in behind him, he was done. Manny got in behind him a couple of times where there was, even when they were playing quite deep and they were protecting, Leicester took an early lead. I think this Vardy scored after 9 minutes or something like that, and there was about four or five opportunities where Salah spun him and got in behind. That's the concern you will have. That's the top end stuff, and that's really going to be the test, not a game against a kind of a toothless Chelsea attack that was so important.
But here's the thing though, United kept two clean sheets at Old Trafford last year. And
okay.
Now they've already reached 50% of that.
Do you think?
And a large part of that is down to the same time,
like, was it hit the post twice? That could have been.
But they didn't score.
Yeah, I know. But look, okay, I'll rephrase it. Do you think not having Harry Maguire there would have made that much of a difference?
I think
towards that Chelsea attack.
I think United would have conceded yesterday if United didn't have Harry Maguire.
I thought Chelsea were quite
Wan-Bissaka
slow and laboured, and they're missing a bit of spark.
There were times when Chelsea threatened to get in behind and they didn't. If it was Jones or Smalling or Bailly in the middle with Ashley Young at the right, Chelsea would have got in a lot more yesterday. Like, I think Wan-Bissaka had 6 or 7 tackles that he won. Same for Maguire, also won a couple of duels in the air. Like, it's a small battle that win the games, and I 100% think that United would have conceded if those two players weren't playing against Chelsea.
Yeah, time and see. I just thought that Chelsea attack was so slow and late.
They'll come up against better opposition. There's no doubt about that. But United conceded against this type of opposition last year.
I guess so.
And having Maguire and Wan-Bissaka in the team adds that solidity that they might not concede as many goals and as many silly goals against lower end opposition. United lost too many goals and lost too many games against smaller opposition last year. That was where the killer. They were never going to put it up to the top three anyway of Tottenham, City and Liverpool. And when it did, they just sat back and, you know, took everything on their backs and just parked the bus and tried their best not to concede. Whereas when it was the games when they were going out to win, that they were caught badly defensively. And that's where that's where Maguire and Wan-Bissaka come in, really, for me.
Just a random question. Do you think United fans are going to be okay with playing such a defensive shape over the course of the season?
United fans will be happy as long as they're scoring goals and winning games.
Because it is a very un-United setup at the moment.
It's
Well,
it's based on the same concept as Fergie had in the 90s, and that's pace out the wings. And because at times United were playing 4-4-2 against Chelsea, and that hasn't been played at Old Trafford in about 5 or 6 years. Probably since Ferguson was there last, there hasn't been a 4-4-2 formation played at Old Trafford. And the worry United fans might have is that they're completely one-dimensional. That when we come up against the teams like Burnley, like just the more defensive team, I was going to say Brighton, but Brighton aren't going to be playing defensive under Graham Potter this year. But those type of sides are going to set a wee bit deeper, aren't going to be allowing United to break on the counter-attack. They're not going to be leaving those gaps in for Rashford and Martial to intertwine. That's when United are going to struggle this year, and that's probably why they kept Juan Mata around. And their midfield is the biggest worry.
Players who can play in those kind of small pockets and spaces, and there aren't too many.
Mata is the only one that United have right now that can come in and completely change the game. He might slow it down, but that's actually a bonus.
Because Pogba can kind of do that because he can play the killer ball, but
Pogba slows everything down though.
Yeah, but he did play some excellent.
He played a 70-yard pass right to Rashford's feet to play him in, but the problem is with Pogba is he's still so hot and cold that he never does the simple pass that.
And I will go back to like the first half where he was, I think it was a Cruyff turn in a almost like a right back, or I can't remember exactly.
Yeah,
but
near Wan-Bissaka.
And you're kind of like, why?
Yeah, what are you doing? All he needs to do.
Just flick it out.
The way he'll become a complete midfielder is when he finally realizes that doing the simple thing is often the best thing to do. Because even though he was actually really good in the second half and he played that phenomenal pass to Rashford, and his ability cannot be doubted at this stage. It's just he's so frustrating to watch at times when he's doing those little cross turns, when he's taking that extra touch in his own half, and it's always in his own half that he takes them. He's putting the defence at risk of being overrun, and against the bigger sides like Jonathan's talking about, they will be overrun.
Yeah, it's a game management kind of issue. I mean,
yeah, I couldn't just commit to him. I can only imagine if he channeled his inner Jordan Henderson or something. Yeah,
maybe.
If it was a different world and he was wearing the red of Liverpool, the level of disgust from the cop would be something else at times if he was trying some of those turns. But we all say about Pogba, remarkably talented player. But at times, you know, you heard him, you've seen him described as the YouTube player, kind of a bit out for what I can do myself. But just to channel that in the right regard for the team is a challenge. Many managers have tried, hasn't really worked to date. So maybe he's angling for the big move again and he'll put in a performance. But United will need a performance because I do think there's no real other legs, pace, drive in that midfield that they are going to need, particularly if they're going to be doing this kind of sit deep and break on the counter. They will need his class on the ball. They will need his energy, his drive, because as I said, there isn't really that many, much more legs really in the rest of the midfield options.
Yeah, final point of order, and it was something I saw. It was our colleague Stephen Doyle talking to Pat Nevin post-match at Newcastle, and obviously they lost to Arsenal. Arsenal have signed Kieran Tierney, and I think Pat was making the point that should he develop the way he should be, he'll probably develop into a slightly better version of Andy Robertson. Do you agree with that? I know obviously you have your Liverpool hat on at times,
but
obviously you're a Celtic fan as well.
So like what I will say is a remarkable talented player, but if he's to overlap Robertson, look, Robertson would be the best left back in Europe for the last 2 years, played in the last two Champions League finals, has been part of a brilliant Liverpool defence, has stood out in both ends of the pitch, has stood out in big games. You even look back to the first leg against Barcelona in the Nou Camp, some of the last-ditch tackles that he did was remarkable. If we're speaking about Tierney in those levels, he has a long way to go before he gets there. Has he the potential? Of course he has. But it'll be interesting to see. It's a great move, I think, for him. I still can't get over my head how Celtic have let him go so cheap in this climate. But I suppose that's another discussion. But yeah, no, he will. He has the potential. And Arsenal play a style of football that I think has the potential to get the best out of him as well. He'll have European football there as well. He'll have the top end of Premier League football, and he has some of the best strikers in the world in front of him now as well, so he can really, really get in a system where he is flowing in the assists. If he gets to that level where he's flowing in the assists like Robertson is, he definitely has the potential. But yeah, the Jets a bit. Yeah.
Fortunately, he has a very reliable defender like David Luiz to learn from now.
We see that's the thing, though. It's where he's going to be playing, and by the sounds of it, he's going to be playing left off the centre back instead of playing a left wing or a left wing back role.
Right.
Which he's more than capable of doing. He's tactically very intelligent, very fast, strong, can win challenges, can burst forward when he needs to, very good in the ball. And for me, he's more suited as a left wing back, but he has the ability to play in different positions, and I think that's probably the bonus he has over Robertson.
You mean in a wing back as in a 3-5-2 rather than 4?
Yeah, as in a 3-5-2, or he could play as an out and out left back.
Did you say Arsenal are playing on a left sided centre half?
By the sounds of it, yeah. So he's going to be playing as part of the three.
That's where you would have concerns, particularly in the Premier League. It's a different though play.
But he's played it at international level. Yeah,
big difference between that and top level football in the Premier League. If you're looking
really between international level.
Oh yeah, for sure,
not having that.
Look at Kyle Walker playing on the right hand side for England, and he got absolutely murdered in the end. That's how England got knocked out in the end, because they exploited the weaknesses in having a fullback playing on that role. The top end players, there's a big difference between left sided centre half, even of the three.
It's a completely different position, yeah. But I'm not having the argument that international level football at a competitive level, not international friendlies, is not up to the same standard as Premier League football. You're playing against the same players.
Yeah, Premier League football is way better.
So, without going off a complete tangent, yeah. What about the World Cup? Is that a completely different? Is that a lower level to the Premier League?
Yes.
In the old days, the World Cup always set the template tactically.
No, it's not, because
it's changed.
The game has evolved so much. It's a tactical game now. You're playing in, like, you take Premier League teams. They're teams that have been together for I don't know how long. The philosophies have been.
It's a completely different thing playing club level.
The standard is as a result of that.
The standard is not above that. Not at the World Cup. Not in European qualifiers. It's basically like comparing the La Liga to the Bundesliga to the Premier League. There's different levels.
Premier League football is the best out of international players, not just because it's players from a particular region.
Not having that. Anyway, on Tierney.
You're wrong.
I completely
that is
different.
That's another day.
I completely disagree with that.
I think from chats we've had on Team 33 before, I know Joe's said consistently he thinks international football isn't quite at the same level.
No,
so that's
not
one side. I think it changed over the years as well, where international football was ahead, and then
The Champions League is now more important and is now a higher standard than international football.
For the very, very top clubs, yeah. Yes. Not the
when you get to the last 16.
Even later, probably quarterfinals, because you still have a lot of dross in the last 16 from time to time.
By process of elimination, yeah. But if you're saying that the Premier League is a better standard than
the top end.
But if you're going from the quarterfinals of the World Cup, where the best players for their nations are playing against each other, that is not a lower standard than playing the Premier League.
But are there any great, really great international?
Yeah,
sides
tell me a good international team
since Spain kind of fell away.
A good international team. England, Brazil, they're all a collection of the best players from the best nations. I'm not even going to go into this, because I'm going to go off on one. The one thing me and Jonathan can actually agree on tonight, and it's the 25 million fee for Tierney is an absolute insult, and Peter Lawl should hang his head in shame for the transfers that he has done for Celtic in the last few years. They might say there is a counter argument to say that, you know, he's turned a profit on these players, but it's a joke. He sold Van Dijk for 13 million, which wasn't enough at the time. He sold Dembele for 19 million, which was 15 million less than he got offered the year before. And now he's sold Kieran Tierney, who has more experience internationally, more club experience, Champions League experience against top clubs like Barcelona, didn't look out of his depth whatsoever, for half of the price than Wan-Bissaka signed for United. Tyrone Mings cost Aston Villa the same amount that Kieran Tierney cost Arsenal. And it's only down to the fact that he plays in Scotland.
But
I'm
not also.
But I presume Celtic are putting clauses in, so when there's a sell on, no.
There is a sell on, but it's not much.
Yeah, usually they're kind of like 5% or something along
those
lines.
You have to factor in as well that you'll tell me more clearly and from following them a bit closer, but I, from my mind, I don't believe Tierney particularly agitated the move or really was.
No,
wanted him, he didn't want to, wasn't if he's going, the club had to go, oh, we have to sell him, the player doesn't want to stay here.
No, it's...
So it's it, that's even...
It was time for him to leave Celtic. It was time to, for him to progress his career further. And it is a good time. He's Celtic. He's a Celtic boy. He came up through the academy at eight years old. There's pictures of him with Shinsuke Nakamura and all the players as academy player. He came through. He was captain at 19 of the club, captain Scotland at 20. And he is a Celtic player. And his apology to the fans, it was an apology rather than a goodbye letter. And he has taken a lot of slack from certain circles of Celtic, but that they're not real fans, in my opinion. He'll be a real loss for Celtic. That's the biggest issue right now, is that Celtic are not going to replace him. And certainly the player that they've got in isn't up to the standard that Tierney is.
I think, did he struggle in one of the Champions League qualifier games?
Yeah, last week he was all over the place. He kept giving the ball away. But yeah, if he develops to the player that I think he could be, he'll be worth 70, 80 million in like 3 or 4 years' time, no doubt.
Well, we'll see what happens. He probably will stay at Arsenal for most of that period anyway. But Richard Dunn coming up now. So I was chatting to him at the Premier Sports launch last week, and it was mostly around the whole issue of him kind of living in Monaco, what he's doing in terms of coaching, does he have ambitions in those areas, and then a little bit about the Premier League. So here it is.
Here at the Premier Sports launch with Richard Dunn, one of our mighty centre-halves from the past. You've been living out in Monaco for the last few years. How's the French and everything coming along?
It's all right, yeah. It was very difficult at the start, but then my kids picked it up in school and started speaking behind me.
They forced
you. Yeah, I had to understand what they were on about, so I'm getting there. I'm not too far away.
Yeah, one of the things you've done there as well, you have the FMC Elite Academy, isn't it? Yeah, so I was looking at the website and kind of judging stuff from what you'd said before about the importance of street football, you know, that a lot of modern academies are like factories. And I noticed you kind of put an emphasis on fun in the sun. I believe that's deliberate, I guess.
Yeah, it's important when we hold camps, and I see other camps and it's all about these drills and different things. And the favourite thing that we do with the kids, we just play old-fashioned World Cup, everyone against each other, and let's go for it. And they love it and they just want to keep going. And I think there's times and places for drills and sessions and organised football, but there's also time for kids to just relax and enjoy it and play it as it's meant to be, as a fun game. And sometimes that gets lost in people trying to force their kids to be footballers, or coaches trying to force kids to become footballers and thinking, well, I'm a coach, I'm going to make the next Messi or the next Damien Duff or Robbie Keane or whatever it is like that, and just let them develop and let them play.
Yeah, you mentioned Robbie and Damien there. Obviously, they're both on their, on that coaching ladder now at different stages of it. Was that something you wanted to kind of follow through at club level, or are you kind of happy enough doing what you're doing in terms of, you know, the kind of summer training camps with children over in Monaco?
So when I started it was... didn't really have an interest in coaching. I wanted to do different things. I wanted to have a break when I retired, and I've done that. And then just through being a dad, I suppose, I ended up coaching my own son, his team, and that's how it is. And I'll continue to coach his team for the next couple of years or however long. And along the way, I'm working with the Irish under 16 team, and I've completed my A licence and stuff like that. So spoke to Damon and spoke to Robbie about going up and seeing how they're working at their clubs, and I think there's plenty of time for learning and progression before I hopefully one day I might pursue a career in coaching and in a more professional level. And but for the moment I enjoy what I do, and it's for me that's more important than than going and playing or coaching again at that top level and being part of all that crazy stuff that comes with it is getting the love back and making sure you enjoy it first and foremost.
Yeah, am I right? Monaco invited you in a few years ago just to talk to their players as well. Like, what was that experience like?
Yeah, it was strange. It was one guy that I know, he was part of the education at the academy there as well. So they were doing an English course, French course, and they wanted me to come in and speak, and almost as a to speak about my experiences in football, and certainly as an academy player at Everton, and how that was, and speak it in English, so to help the kids understand English, but also help them understand how football has changed over the years. And it is it's strange, because when I speak about my experiences, which is, I think, what made me into a footballer, was having that respect for the first team and having your jobs of cleaning the football, cleaning the footballs, cleaning the boots, cleaning the dressing rooms and all that stuff. Whereas the generation at Monaco was like, well, that's complete disrespect. What are they doing to you? That shouldn't be allowed and all that stuff. And it's like, well, to get the respect and to become a professional footballer, it's not easy. You know, you have to get your hands dirty, you have to work hard, and you have to be willing to do things, jobs around the club or whatever it is, to get that place. And now it's expected that it just comes, and that's probably not the right way to do it.
Yeah, the interesting one was Lillian Thuram's son, I think, was the only one who kind of probably understood you a little bit, in terms of, like, his father obviously would have gone through around the same time as yourself and probably would have done the exact same things.
Yeah, he was really, really clever boy as well, you know. He's I think he's actually played for the first team since then, and he was someone who you can tell that has been around football his whole life. Obviously his dad is a World Cup winner and a legend, so the expectation on him is probably high. But because he I felt at the time he was really level-headed, he's actually been able to bring that out and become a first-team player, whereas you could tell there were certain people in the room who thought they had a divine right to be footballers, you know, and that's not necessarily the best way to go about it.
Yeah, and having seen all of that now, and obviously I think I remember chatting to you about 3-4 years ago, where I think you'd said you'd nearly moved to Malaga, with Irish players coming through now, and I kind of asked Gary Breen the same question, because obviously Inter Milan was interested in him at one point. Would you be advising people to maybe try and make that move, maybe not necessarily at the very start of your career, but at a point just to test it out, learn something else, obviously learn a new culture, learn a new language, but another way of playing football?
I think so, yeah. I think there's no harm in it being your first club. I think there's so much emphasis in this country about the Premier League and being there, and that's the Holy Grail and all that stuff, but there's other ways of getting there, you know. And I think I spoke with Graham Barrett last week, who's coaching at Shamrock Rovers, and he wants to bring his kids over to play in France against us, just to give them the experience to open different doors and open their minds to, it doesn't have to be Man United, it can be a different club, it can be a French club, it can be a Belgian club. Wherever you get the opportunity to go and play, take it. You know, there's plenty of Irish players who probably could have made it in different countries, but they were so mindset on being in the Premier League that they never looked outside of it, you know. And I think it's time for us as a country to start develop players with open minds who can go and play not just the English style of football, but also the European style of football, and get new experiences and new academy players playing abroad.
Yeah, I suppose a final question. You played with Vincent Kompany very briefly around the time he'd arrived and just before you'd left Man City. Obviously, he's just gone now. He's gone to Anderlecht as player coach. It's going to be a bit of a void there at City, I guess, because he's such a big personality. Do you think, will it be enough to cause any kind of negative effect within the dressing room?
I don't think so, no. I think the dressing room ran really well at Man City. You know, they all seem to be a good bunch of players, and anyone who's not is soon shipped out. And I think they have a policy in place that the player who's there the longest is the captain, and that's how they run the ship. And they're progressing really well, and they've got used to it, I think, on the pitch over the last few years, where he's missed quite a few games through injury, that they can play games around him. And it's now down to the next leader to make sure that the dressing room remains the same and remains hungry. And you look at some clubs and you think, oh, without the captain they'll really struggle, but Man City have such a clear leader in Pep Guardiola that I don't think it matters who's the captain. I think he's the one that pushes them and drives them forward and keeps everyone in line. And having the opportunity to play for them, knowing that you're going to win trophies, you're going to compete at the highest level, is enough to keep people in line.
Yeah, and finally, are you convinced by Harry Maguire? Do you think he's, well, obviously 80 million is quite a lot of money, but do you think he's going to be what Man United, I suppose, expect him to be?
I think so. I think Man United are lacking a centre-back, a dominant centre-half, someone who they can look to and sort of define Manchester United. When you used to look at Ferdinand and Vidic, you knew they were like the backbone of Man United, and I think that's what they need now. I think Harry Maguire has the talent to do it. I think he's seems to be a very level-headed player and person who will take it in a stride. I don't think by any stretch of the imagination he's the best defender in the world, but I think he's, for what Man United need, I think he's an ideal signing for them.
All right, Richard, thanks a million for your time.
Nice one, thank you.
All right, that was Richard Dunn speaking to me last week at the launch of Premier Sports' Premier League coverage, and that brings us to a close for this week. Jonathan Higgins, thanks a million for coming in.
Pleasure as always.
And a call.
Not a bother. We're going to continue that World Cup chat.
I think it's definitely worth bringing up because I think I'm leaning towards Jonathan on it, but that's kind of just what I've read over the years.
It's because I'm right.
But, well, it's more nuanced than that. But I think there's a fair argument on both sides. But obviously, I can't be biased, and I have to stay somewhere in the middle. But anyway, that's it for this week's show. We'll be back next week. Take it away, Johan.